There's this experience I've been noticing more often as of late, and I suspect that you might know what I'm talking about, even if you don't really have a name for it. So let's say it's Saturday afternoon, and you have nowhere to be. The apartment's fine. The fridge has some food in it. You're not putting out any fires anywhere. Even the weather is cooperating nicely. And yet, you feel nothing. Except there is this rather flat neutrality that, where something should register as leisure, it just registers as time slipping away. And you're not experiencing depression or having some sort of crisis or anything like that. There's just this, like this vacancy where feeling used to be. And there's a clinical term for this called anhedonia. So, anhedonia, if you're not familiar with it, it's the diminished capacity to experience pleasure from things that used to produce it. And this used to be a symptom of that you'd find listed under depression or even schizophrenia in the diagnostic manuals. But nowadays, it's actually showing up in people with no diagnosable condition whatsoever. So just ordinary people in ordinary circumstances, who have somehow lost access to ordinary pleasure. I personally have experienced this on and off for many years in my life. And the part that strikes me as somewhat comically absurd about this is that humanity has spent the overwhelming majority of its existence in conditions of misery, being cold, being hungry, uncertain, exhausted, lost, and so forth. Basically locked in a brutal struggle for survival, desperately trying to achieve comfort and safety. And then finally, at some point, for the most part, we achieved it. We were finally winning. And in fact, we started winning so hard that we were awarded a clinical condition from having too much of it. We have this exquisitely sensitive reward system built by millions of years of evolution, and we basically broke it in about 50 years with smartphones and social media and streaming services and same-day delivery, which is quite an impressive achievement when you think about it, but it's not exactly the kind that anyone was aiming for. So, let's talk about what is actually happening with this neurologically. Because I think this is the area that changes the conversation from I'm just not a very enthusiastic person to, oh, something's been done to my brain and I'd like to speak to someone about it. There's a Stanford psychiatrist named Anna Lemke who wrote a book called Dopamine Nation. And her clinical observation, after years of treating addiction and increasingly people with no addiction at all, is that the brain maintains something like a pleasure-pain balance, like a seesaw. Every dopamine spike gets followed by a compensatory dip on the other side. So the brain is always trying to return to an equilibrium. And that's fine when the spikes are occasional and when there's actually some recovery time in between them, because basically it functions when the baseline gets a chance to reset. Now, the problem is what happens when the spikes come fast and fast enough and frequently enough that the baseline itself starts to shift. And then the dips become, well, they accumulate. So what happens is the seesaw gets stuck on the wrong side. And what once was pleasurable becomes, I guess, neutral. And what was neutral starts to feel like deprivation, which is anhedonia. And it's not a character flaw. It's a calibration problem where the reward system, it's not actually broken. It's just been reset to a threshold that ordinary life can no longer access. And what I find particularly uncomfortable about Lemke's framing is the implication, because the thing that's doing most of the recalibrating, it isn't heroin or alcohol or those sorts of substances, it's the phone. It's the social media feed, and you know, it's also just the endless availability of low effort, high stimulation content that's specifically engineered being the key word here, to produce dopamine responses in the most efficient way possible. And that is a remarkable thing to have built. But it's a catastrophic thing to have handed to an entire civilization at the same time. All right. So this is the part that I find to be actually upsetting, because the anhedonia problem, it isn't just about phones and social media, of course. Oh, no. It goes deeper than that. And it goes further back. There is a neuroscientist named Robert Sapolsky, who you might be familiar with from his writings on determinism. But he's also written extensively about the dopamine system. And one of his more interesting findings is that dopamine isn't primarily released during reward. It's released during the anticipation of reward. So it's really the wanting and not the actual getting where most of the neurological action is happening, which means that the most pleasurable moment in pretty much every experience that we have is usually right before it happens. For example, the smell of food before you take the first bite, or something like the moment right before you, or the moment you open something, that you've been waiting for, right before you open that thing. So it's the anticipation that's actually playing the biggest part in the overall experience. And what the modern life has, you know, systematically removed through things like instant delivery and instant access to pretty much everything is the waiting, the anticipation, which is that's the neurological precondition for satisfaction. Your great-grandmother waited weeks for a letter, and the anticipation, that was a big part of the experience. The arrival meant something because the absence had been felt. But, you know, at this point in time, you can contact anyone on the planet in 30 seconds, right? But you'll likely feel almost nothing about it. There's no anticipation. And then there's Johann Hari, who wrote about how the attention economy doesn't just steal your focus, it also basically hijacks that anticipation system. Because the feed is designed to feel like something good might be coming, you know, just one more scroll, without ever actually delivering it. So it's like a permanent state of maybe. Maybe the next thing will be interesting. Maybe the next one will actually matter. And that maybe never resolves into anything. This is basically a dopamine casino. You're playing the slot machines. And, you know, this is where the anticipation just goes on and on and on with no resolution. And a system that never gets to rest, eventually it's going to stop responding. So this is like the neurological equivalent of being perpetually almost hungry, never actually being fed, you're kind of hovering in that space between those two things indefinitely. So, all right, there is a philosopher by the name of Albert Borgman who wrote about something that he called the device paradigm. And Borgman isn't exactly a household name, which I think is kind of a shame because his ideas actually, his ideas are actually some of the more clarifying things that I've come across for why modern comfort feels so strangely unsatisfying. So his observation was that pre-modern life was full of what he called focal practices. So these were activities that were effortful and involved actual skill, like chopping wood for heat, being an obvious example. Though I want to acknowledge that might sound insufferably romantic until you've actually done it, at which point it just sounds accurate, I guess. I used to chop a lot of wood. Because the thing about chopping wood is that it produces warmth, and it also produces something in the person doing the chopping. You get this tiredness in your arms and your shoulders afterwards that makes sitting down feel like something that you earned rather than something that you just defaulted into. So the process is, well, the process and the outcome are inseparable. Now, on the other hand, we've got these modern devices that deliver the commodity, but they also completely eliminate the process. So, for example, we've got central heating, which it delivers the warmth, but that's pretty much it, nothing else. And yes, it's convenient, and it's something of a modern miracle, but nonetheless, it is apparently slowly making us miserable in ways that nobody fully predicted, and we still haven't fully accounted for. And so Borgmann made the argument that we've been trading engagement for convenience for so long now that we've largely forgotten that engagement is part of the deal. Which brings us to the App Store. Where you can now download an application that guides you through a breathing exercise specifically designed to produce the feeling of calm that, interestingly, your other 17 apps have been systematically destroying. And this is not a niche product. This is a multi-billion dollar industry. I mean, there's an entire economy built around selling people the neurological states that a different economy spent 40 years dismantling. Okay. There's something else running alongside the dopamine problem. And this has been documented for decades without anyone apparently doing anything about it. And it's called hedonic adaptation. And the basic finding is that humans are remarkably good at returning to a stable emotional baseline, regardless of what happens to us. You win the lottery, or you have a serious accident. Within a year or so, you're going to be roughly back to baseline. So the brain, it normalizes. And it's actually a pretty amazing piece of psychological engineering, except in the context of constant novelty and stimulation. It becomes like a trap. And this is because every new pleasure, it raises the bar. So what used to be exciting becomes ordinary. And then what's ordinary becomes insufficient. So the threshold keeps moving upward, and the capacity to find satisfaction in simple things keeps gradually eroding. There's a book by Oliver Berkman called 4,000 Weeks, where he explains that the more options that are available to us, the less satisfying any single choice becomes. I mean, we have the capability now to listen to any piece of music ever recorded, and yet we spend 40 minutes choosing something, but we still end up mildly disappointed at whatever we picked. Because somewhere in the back of your mind is that pesky, nagging little awareness of everything that you didn't pick. So basically, the opportunity cost of any choice ends up becoming its own source of dissatisfaction. And so what this produces, combined with the dopamine recalibration, is a person who's overstimulated and underwhelmed at the same time. And that's where we are. We have access to more than any human in history, but nonetheless, we find this consistently less than enough. Sometimes even to the point of choice paralysis, which is, you know, medically speaking, that's a very strange place to have arrived at. Especially when you consider that there are still plenty of people in this world who would love to have this kind of problem. Humans are very complicated creatures. Okay, so here is where the research gets a little uncomfortable. Because if you follow the neuroscience of what actually produces satisfaction, the answer is actually resistance, not more comfort. There's a psychologist named Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, and yes, that name is its own form of effortful engagement, who spent many years studying what he called flow, where the state of complete absorption in a challenging activity, it correlates most strongly with reported well-being. And his finding was that flow actually requires difficulty. So if it's too easy, well, then you get boredom. And if it's too hard, you get anxiety. So the sweet spot is it's the edge of your capability where the outcome isn't guaranteed, and therefore the experience, it actually registers. And that sweet spot is exactly what modern life has been systematically engineering out of existence. Because, well, the entire logic of convenience is the elimination of difficulty, right? So every optimized upgrade and every experience without any difficulty is moving in the opposite direction from where the research says satisfaction actually exists. And we've been moving in that direction with a great deal of enthusiasm for decades, while wondering why everything feels increasingly flat. And I think the uncomfortable implication here, the one that doesn't fit on a wellness app, and I'm sure someone somewhere has tried, is that the path back to feeling runs through resistance rather than around it. It isn't suffering for its own sake. It's just the ordinary difficulty of doing something hard enough to matter. And, you know, to feel some satisfaction in overcoming. So look at it this way. Your ancestors almost certainly had objectively more difficult lives. And yet, the evidence suggests that they probably experience more satisfaction in an average day than most people nowadays manage in a month. And that's not meant to be a romanticization of hardship. It's just what the dopamine research implies if you follow it far enough. All right, so I suppose we've come to the point where you might be wondering, well, what do you actually do with this information? And look, I'm aware this is sometimes the part of the monologue where I'm supposed to pivot into actionable steps or some protocol or something. You know, something that you can screenshot and slap on your fridge. But I'm going to resist that, partly because I try to avoid platitudes, and partly because the research actually points to somewhere more specific and considerably less photogenic than a morning routine or whatever. So, all right. The first thing that the neuroscience suggests is reintroducing some resistance deliberately. Not all the time, just sometimes choosing the harder version of something, like cooking instead of ordering, or walking instead of riding. You know, maybe making something with your hands that might actually fail. How about actually talking with someone in person rather than on the internet? And I know that's asking a lot. And you're not doing this because suffering is noble or anything like that. It's just that the brain needs effort before reward to register the reward at all. And I think the second thing is protecting anticipation. Don't immediately consume the thing that you want. Let it be wanted for a while. The wanting is actually where the feeling lives. And Sapolsky's research is pretty clear on this. You know, modern life, it's effectively eliminated waiting as an experience. And if you can reintroduce even small amounts of it, I think it changes the thing feels, you know, it changes what the thing feels like when it finally arrives. And probably the most useful thing, just try to reduce the stimulus baseline once in a while. Not permanently, just enough that ordinary things start registering again. Like the first coffee you've had after a period without coffee. Now for me, that's about 30 minutes. But anyway, my point is, it tastes like coffee is supposed to taste when you've had a break. Now, that's just one example. I mean, there are many examples where this principle applies, obviously. Which is really, I think, just another way of saying the feeling we started with has an answer. And the answer is less convenient than the problem. That Saturday afternoon feeling at the beginning where I was talking about with the vacant flatness and the leisure that doesn't feel like leisure, I don't think that's really a mystery anymore. I think it's a signal. And I think it's a signal that the reward system is telling you that it's been reset to a threshold where scrolling and streaming and, you know, same day delivery can't reach. And the things that can reach it are inconvenient and take effort, and they involve real uncertainty about the outcome. And, you know, when you think about it, this is just a description of being alive. The actual version of being alive, not the streamlined one. And I suppose maybe that's where this ends. Just, you know, it's just having this deeper observation that the feeling is telling you something real. And that real is probably worth more than a superficial type of comfortable, which is the thing that's majorly contributing to our modern anhedonia. All right. And with that, I think that's all I have on that subject. So, as always, thanks for listening.